Good morning. So why don't we go ahead and get started? I can't believe I'm saying this, but this is our last class for the Glenn and Doyle class for the semester. We have a new module of classes starting next week, so please do make sure that you look at your notices for that. We don't have a specific parenting track for that module. I spoke with some families who said that sometimes it was really hard because there was like this loyalty to the parenting track because you really wanted it to exist, but then you also might see a class that you wanted to go visit and check out. And so we have a few options available for you, but not one specifically for families. But then starting in the spring, we have a very long, like 9 to 10 week class for families. So we can look for that. You can look for that in your notices. I'd like for us to try to not get distracted by this beautiful baby. I'm also distracted. But why don't we open in prayer? Let us pray. God, we give you great thanks for this beautiful day, for the season of autumn and the harvest it brings. Lord, may we harvest within ourselves love, joy, peace, and compassion. And may we, through the study of Scripture and through worship and through community, learn how to go out from this place and into the world to love each other in your name, knowing that the greatest commandment is to love you and then to love our neighbors that you have created as ourselves. Lord, we love you and we thank you, and it's in your name that we pray. Amen. So Alina and I were brainstorming about how to end a class like this, because I feel like the topic of compassion is big, and we could continue to do this for like 7 years and still come up with things to talk about. But one of the themes that is really prevalent in her work is a theme of unbecoming. So if you look at the arc of Glennon's life, she tells the story of how she became a lot of things. Became a bulimic, became an alcoholic, etc. And then she refers to herself as being a recovering everything. Sort of every, like all these little nooks and crannies of her life were things that she needed to get rid of. But one of the things that's unique about Love Warrior is it begins to tell the story of her not just getting rid of a lot of things, but unbecoming those things in order to then become her true self. And we've seen a lot of that even after Love Warrior in her life, as she has shared. And so I want us to talk a little bit about what unbecoming means using some stories from her book. And I know that Alina brought this up, and I thought it was really just on point when we were talking this week, that the holidays can be a very, very stressful time for us as we feel like expectations are being placed on us. And we can feel sometimes like we might honestly need to unbecome some of these roles that are being put on us from the outside. Please come on in. We are just getting started. I was giving a little recap of what we're going to, or I guess a first explanation of what we're going to talk about today. Talking about Glennon's story of unbecoming. So she was unbecoming some things about herself in order to try to become her true self. And I was talking specifically about the relationship between that and expectations. So we sort of, in my opinion, have our own values, things that we think are vitally important. And then in my situation, I know I have my values and then I have my to-do list. And they aren't always on the same page. I do not often spend all of my time doing things that are also the most important things in my life. And so how do we tighten the gap, right? How do we define our values and then put that up as the measuring stick that we use to make decisions? And I was thinking about holidays specifically. There tends to be a lot of pressure to, even I think sometimes around Halloween, you know, make sure your child's costume is the world's best costume. I'm looking at all the moms that people are making for homecoming and this like expectation of like, is my mom gonna be like top the charts, etc. And that all goes into your family system. Some of you are laughing. I hope it's empathy, because I think I see, I think I've gotten a few Facebook statuses of like, well, it's midnight. I've finished all of my children's costumes and I have to be somewhere at 9 a.m. I guess I should now do mine, you know, like the sort of last opportunity. And then the question being, so if this is how we're spending our time, Is this how we believe our time is best spent? How are our values that we've chosen showing up in things like having the best Halloween costume, having the best mom, or making the absolute best Thanksgiving dinner that anyone could ever imagine, et cetera, et cetera? And maybe that is your joy. You know, maybe it is actually joyful for you to create these costumes. I know plenty of people for whom that is like one of their arts. And so it is vitally important to them, and it completely locks into their values. So the question is whether it is or not, not that it is or isn't. And so what I want us to think about is, we're going to read some of her stories, but Alina used a really nice metaphor, I thought, which was the idea of a plate. So a full plate, we all would, that's sort of a thing we might say, oh, I have a really full plate right now, I'm really busy. But how do we turn that into a practice of first putting our values on the plate, and then whatever else just fills the space that is remaining? Mary is very passionate about this. But how do we put values on the plate first and then put everything else around that? I know that I don't do that. I tend to start by filling my plate with expectations, outside, you know, asks or things to do. And so I guess the question would be, how do we choose values over expectations? And what I think Glennon really models through the stories that we're about to read is listening to yourself, getting to know yourself, and then also listening to your body. And so we're going to use those two examples from her work. And then I actually brought an activity. It's by Brené Brown. But it is a way to sort of go through and do a values assessment. So it has a ton of values that you might want to, might consider to be most important to you. And then you can go through as a couple, as a family, as an individual, and pick which values will sort of light the way and be at the forefront of what you're doing. So we'll do that at the end. But why don't we get started with our first story of Unbecoming from Glennon. Glennon writes, okay, so she's gone to the beach. Okay, this is something that Alina talked about. She's gone to the beach. She's trying to have some away time, and she writes this. The other people on the beach start to leave, but I am not ready. I stay still, so I learn that the sky keeps exploding once the sun is gone. Deeper reds and brilliant purples continue to wrap around me like blankets until it all fades into pitch navy. Then I turn around and catch a glimpse of the moon, a silver boomerang in the sky that seems to have appeared out of the literal blue. But I know the moon's always there, too, waiting for its time to be seen. The day has to fall away to make way for the night, and the night has to surrender its place so the day can have its turn. This strikes me as a holy rhythm. I wonder if whatever caused this rhythm of the tides and the sky and the sun and the moon has a holy rhythm for my life, too. I consider that perhaps I'm in the middle of a cycle. Maybe there is a time for everything. Maybe there is a timekeeper. My eyes fall below the moon to the plants that line the beach, every shade of purple, green, and pink. I think maybe some loves are perennials. They survive the winter and bloom again. Maybe others are annuals, beautiful and lush and full for a season, and then back to the earth to die and create rich soil for new life to grow. Maybe there is no way for love to fail, because the eventual result of all love is new life. Death and resurrection, maybe that's just the way of life and love. I decide that regardless of whether my marriage reveals itself to be an annual or a perennial love, there will be new lushness and beauty and life that comes from it. I can only see my toes through the white flashlight of the moon, and I note that even at night there is some light to see by. We are never without light. There is no true disaster. I find myself thanking the moon and the one who created it. I use the moonlight to gather my wrappers and my mug and my blanket. I stand up, look around, and notice I'm the only one left on the beach. I've been sitting on the sand for 8 hours. I walk back to my room, and I do not stop to wash my feet at the fountain. I keep all the sand and salt attached to me. I need to bring it with me inside. I sit down on the bed, the sandy blanket still wrapped around me, and I call my mom. When she answers, I say, Mama, I think I found something today that my soul loves. I sat on the beach for 8 hours today. I listened to the surf and I felt like it was speaking to me. It was reassuring me or something, trying to show me how things work. And when the sun set, I felt so held by the sky, like it was covering me and protecting me. My mom says, "Oh, honey, that takes me back. You've loved the sound of the ocean since you were 3. When we get close to the beach, you kick your feet against your car seat and squeal, and we'd laugh and laugh. Then the second you got to the sand, you'd take off toward the sea. Sand and water have always been home to you." As she speaks, the tears come and they feel cleansing, like an organic baptism. There it is, something I've loved since I was 3 and will still love when I'm 83. Here I am on a bed in a hotel room all by myself, meeting myself. I've learned one true thing about me. Maybe there is more for me to learn. Hello, soul. I'm learning what you love. I will get more of this for us, I promise. I have met myself, and I am going to care for her fiercely, at least as fiercely as I care for everyone else in my life. I will not abandon, ignore, or lose myself again. So Glennon has an experience of figuring out something that is true about her after feeling extreme betrayal, right? So a lot of things are thrown into question when we feel betrayal. And so she is then having a moment of figuring out truth. Truth that is to her. So it's not outside truth, it's internal truth. And so I'm curious if there are areas of your life that you feel like you were introduced to. Like, what are ways that you feel like maybe along your path you have met yourself? So I'll use an example from my life because it's a difficult question. So God ordained a priest. That worked, right? I didn't do anything to be made a priest. But I have moments when I'm actually officiating certain services or consecrating things or blessing people that I feel like I'm actually meeting myself, right? Where I'm actually present and I'm fully there, and I'm able to almost see in myself something that I can often not see in myself, which is this identity of being a priest. That to me is kind of a lot bigger. This is a very small thing. It's about learning what's something that makes her soul happy. But in those moments for me, it is a reminder to me that my soul is actually most calm when it is behind an altar. And it takes certain moments for me to be reminded of that. So are there, I guess, moments in your life where you are reminded of your core values? Yeah.
This year, have really learned to enjoy that again. And a lot of that's been spiritual in terms of finding out, getting involved with another CEO group and finding out that owning a business doesn't have to be from fear.
Mm.
That for 24 years, I've been run by fear, fear of failure, or fear of not being able to make payroll, or fear of recession, or fear of a client. having an accident with a client who's been suing us or whatever. So there's a lot of spiritual stuff in that for me, learning that it can be about fun, and then that if I'm really trusting in God's plan for me, that I don't have to be coming from fear. But then I've also gotten more involved with clients in a different way this year, and finding myself in finding how much I thrive on it, and how much I enjoy being a service to our clients and making things go well for them has been a big coming full circle as to why we started this business. And I've worked harder this year than I have in many years, but it's been fun and more enjoyable in the process. So that's been kind of an interesting place where I didn't expect to find myself again.
That is such a vital and important image of what I'm sort of trying to talk about. So feeling like you're leading out of fear, and then also feeling very aware that that's not working. Like, maybe not necessarily consciously leading out of fear, but putting those two things together and then transforming that into saying, I'm going to lead out of joy. I'm going to lead out of, I think you said, like, silliness or fun or something more lighthearted.
Right.
And then the corresponding reality that that's working. Brené Brown's research is very clear in the fact that when we lead out of fear, negativity, scarcity, etc., we do not reach the goals that we want to. No company, no anything. I mean, she goes to Fortune 500 companies. She goes to all of these different places. And that is diagnosed as, like, leading toward a place of addiction for the people who work for you, for a lack of health within the company, etc. But when we lead out of joy and we lead out of our values of, and maybe your value is honesty, maybe your value is good work ethic, you know, whatever your positive value is, that is how we then get to a place where I sort of think everybody wins, in a sense. Like, employees are more positive, and then also we begin to see the trends that we're looking for out of our vocation. And that, for Brené and her research, is across vocations. So that's not like the business world, the clergy world, that's across vocations. So that's a fantastic example, and I'm really happy to hear that even though it has been difficult, you're seeing new life resurrection there. So why don't we read another story? This is the idea of her body having something to remind her about her values. This is a story, maybe you've read it, where she has decided she's really into yoga, but then she goes into yoga and it's hot yoga, and she's like, why is the air conditioner broken? Like, this is terrible. Why would anyone do this? Which is exactly how I feel about hot yoga. And she is in the whole thing, and everyone has sort of gone around the room, and people are like, I want to find inner peace, you know. And she's like, I want to survive this. Like, I just want to not die on this mat. Like, she's just super blunt about it. So she's having an emotional experience because of what's going on with her body. And she writes, I close my eyes, and when the tears flow downward toward my mat, I feel surprised that there's any liquid left inside me. Then I feel a hand on my arm, and along with it, an immediate twinge of shame. I'm sweaty and crying and snotty and gross, and someone is close to me, up close and touching me. But I do not pull away. I do not wipe my eyes or my nose. I just let us be. I open my eyes, and Amy is right there next to me. She's the yoga instructor. And she says, that, what you just did, that is the journey of the warrior. Now don't forget to breathe. You need to remember to breathe. I do not understand why everyone keeps telling me to breathe. I'm alive, aren't I? Isn't it clear that I must be breathing? And what is the journey of the warrior? Finally, Amy bows to us and tells us that the God in her honors the God in us. She opens the door and the cool air rushes in. I walk out through the lobby and into the sun and experience an overwhelming sense of deja vu. The journey of the warrior. This phrase rings a bell in my soul, but why? I climb into my van, rush home, and pull Pema Chodron's When Things Fall Apart off my nightstand. I flip to a page I have dog-eared, and I run my finger down the lines to a sentence I'd underlined and highlighted, but hadn't really understood until now. This is a quote. So even if the hot loneliness is there, and for 1.6 seconds we sit with it, and wrestle when yesterday we couldn't even sit with it for one, that is the journey of the warrior. I sit down on the floor, and as I read that sentence over and over, I understand that my entire life has been a race from the hot loneliness. I picture 10-year-old me feeling my anger, fear, jealousy, otherness, unbelonging for the first time, and understanding these uncomfortable but normal human feelings to be wrong, shameful. I thought I needed to hide these feelings, escape them, fix them, deliver myself from them. I didn't know that everyone feels the hot loneliness. I didn't know that it would pass. So for the next 20 years, every time anger or fear or loneliness started bubbling up, I reached for an easy button. A book, a binge, a beer, a body, a shopping spree, a Facebook feed, to shove it back down. I'd press that button and find myself magically transported to a pain-free place. Distracted, numbed, underwater, gone, off my mat again and again, running out of here. Oh my God, what if the transporting is keeping me from transformation? What if my anger, my fear, my loneliness were never mistakes, but invitations? What if in skipping the pain, I was missing my lessons? Instead of running away from my pain, was I supposed to run toward it? Perhaps pain was not a hot potato after all, but a traveling professor. Maybe instead of slamming the door on pain, I need to throw open the door wide and say, come in, sit down, and don't leave until you've taught me what I need to know. I've never let myself trust love because I've never let myself trust pain. What if pain, like love, is just a place that brave people visit? What if both require presence, staying on your mat, and being still? If this is true, then maybe instead of resisting the pain, I need to resist the easy buttons. Maybe my reliance on numbing is keeping me from the two things I was born for, learning and loving. I could go on hitting easy buttons until I die and feel no pain, but the cost of that decision could be that I'll never learn, love, or be truly alive. So what she's learning, you know, in our first story, she's learning at least one thing in her life that brings her joy. And then now she's learning about pain as a method of growth and the body as a teacher, the body as a place of wisdom. And so I'm curious if you resonate with this, if you feel like pain has ever been a teacher for you. I think your story is a little bit on that. But do you feel like pain has ever taught you anything?
Not so much pain, but anxiety, which is probably some kind of pain and discomfort. And it's often what makes me want to stop and reset everything again.
Absolutely.
You guys ever seen the movie Click with Adam Sandler, where he has that like magic remote that the guy at Bed Bath & Beyond gives him? Is it Christopher Walken who plays that guy, right? Have you seen this?
Mm-mm.
Oh, this is like all of that. Well, he has this magic remote that the guy in Bed Bath, he goes into Bed Bath & Beyond and says, I need a universal remote. And the guy's like, oh, I've got just the one for you. And invites him back to like the storage room, and it's this, it glows blue or so, I don't know. But anyways, he takes it home, and at some point he realizes it's when he's trying to work on a project. He's kind of a workaholic. His family wants him to spend more time with him. So he manipulates life with the remote control. And so the first thing he does is the dog is barking. Everybody's asleep in the house. And so he grabs the remote control and hits the mute button at the dog, and the dog stops barking, or the noise stops. So you can see the dog barking, and he's like even jumping up and down, but the noise is gone. And he's like, oh my God. You know, he realizes sort of the power that he has. And so then he starts things like fast forwarding through his fights with his wife. And, you know, like, and then all of a sudden the remote sort of takes control of his life. And it flashes forward to when his daughter is a teenager and she's walking around in sort of skimpy clothes. And he's like, how did this happen? You know? And then fast forward to, like, he and his wife are divorced, and he doesn't understand, you know, like, and so he sort of realizes that as he's hit the easy button, quite literally on the remote control, that he's missed huge parts of his life that he, looking back, wishes he had not missed. And so I think some of that for me, I resonate with that because I do think sometimes the easy button, again, she says numbing, she says a few other things in there, but it's that idea of sort of like how we self-medicate sort of as a culture, you know, and like Facebook. I know that that's a thing in our house. In fact, this morning our daughter kind of climbed in my lap during church, and I said, this has pretty much been my whole morning, because she's been sitting on me all morning. And my husband said, well, nobody was sitting on me. And I said, well, you were on your phone. Like, our kids have realized that when we have our phones in front of us, we're not paying attention to them, you know? And so sometimes when they want to fight that, they will literally climb on us and make us pay attention to them. And other times they're like, eh, it's not worth it. I'll go do something else, you know? And so I think that's one of the ways that my husband and I continually struggle, is with our devices, you know, like how much attention are we really paying to our lives? That's for me. I don't know how the rest of y'all find yourselves doing that, but I know for us it has to do with our devices. So,
well, I was appreciative of her list, because I think societally we might look and say, like, drugs, alcohol, like these are might be ways that we numb, but a book, when I heard a binge, I heard of me, I could picture me watching Stranger Things right now. A body, this understanding that how our bodies are involved with that, a shopping spree. Don't even get me started about Target. And like a Facebook feed. Like, these are all different ways of numbing that are not necessarily things that we've societally decided could be bad for us. And I think they're neutral forces, right? Like, all of these things are neutral forces, and it depends on what you do with them. Mm-hmm. You know, like, watching a Netflix show is not a problem. Maybe being able to say that you watched all of Breaking Bad in, like, 3 days is a problem. You know, like, it's just, it's all about moderation. And I had lunch with someone last week, and it was a priest, and she heard the story of a church. It was a church in sort of the outskirts of Manhattan, I guess. But it was not doing well. And the rector was like, I don't know what we're going to do. This is not going well. Like, we should be doing really well, because we're, like, almost in Manhattan, but we're not. And they had, you know, they had a ton of events that were very important to them. But what the leader did is the rector got all of her leadership together, and she said, we have to figure out what our core value is. And then we have to filter everything we do through this core value. And if we have an event, if we have an idea, if we have anything that is outside of this core value, it won't happen. We're going to say no to it. And you can imagine how well this went, you know. But she had all of her leadership team with her, right? So all of her leadership team was on board, and they decided that their highest value is spiritual vitality. So if it is not positively affecting the spiritual lives of our congregation, then it's out. And it was really difficult, because they had some sort of big event. I think it was like an arts festival that they did every year that was like a big deal to everyone. And they were like, this is not aligned with our values, so we're not going to do it. And they're like now one of the most successful congregations in the United States, in the Episcopal Church. They are top 10, I think. So it was just this story, and the reasons that we do this is not so that we have numbers or so that we're the top 10 church in the United States, but, like, health was brought into their system, because instead of looking at, well, all these people are going to say that we have to have this bazaar, and so we just need to make sure that we do, you know, all the things we've always done, they were able to instead start from a place of values. And they still did a lot of the things, you know, formation, all of these things that were integral to the congregation. It was just these few little things that they were like, you know, we're going to cull these things so that we are just completely value-based. And to the point of Brené Brown's research, it ended up really spiritually revitalizing their congregation, which then in turn naturally makes the congregation grow. And so that is a story that has kind of been bubbling in the back of my head about what it means to have values-based leadership and values-based living. And on that note, I want to give you this handout from my girl Brené Brown. This is actually from one of her curricula, so it's not public property, it's copyright. So my only request is that, I mean, not be able to photocopy and sell this to someone, but if you will keep it and use it in your family, feel free to pass it around. And I want to just take a minute and explain to you sort of what we're doing here. So it's a worksheet, it's got two pages. The first page has a lantern, and so we're using the image of a lantern in tandem with the idea of values. And the idea is that values are like a lantern. They light the way. They are how we see in the darkness. And we get to pick a few things. First of all, what is the flame? So what are the 1 to 2 values that light the way for you, that are your true core values? Now, we definitely will have values outside of this, right? We have a lot of values, I think, things that are important to us. But picking those 1 to 2 things that then become the filter through which we think about our decision-making processes. So what are our values? And then number 2 is protecting the flame. So all lanterns have devices, plastic guards that protect the flame. What are the specific behaviors that support and protect your values? Who are the people you want to put around you who support and protect your values? And then you can list people and behaviors that you know help get you centered. And then number 3 is the handle. Sometimes when we're in struggle or feeling overwhelmed, we set down the lantern and we walk away from it, right? So we flee from our values sometimes when we're in times of fear. We feel like we're already carrying so much, but without the light of the lantern, which is our clarity of values, it can get very dark very quickly. Use the handle to identify the behaviors that can serve as a red flag that you've walked away from your light and your values. So she gives you some beginnings of sentences like, I know I'm in trouble when, or I know I've lost my way when, or I know I'm out of alignment with my values when. And then number 4, radiating light. When was the time you embodied your most important values? So being able to call on an experience in which your values were at the forefront of your decision making can then help you in the future when you're making decisions. And the second page is a list of general values. It doesn't necessarily mean that your value's on here. There's opportunities to add some things in. But I know for me, it was really helpful to go through and just read some other things. I ended up highlighting like all of them and then was like, well, that's not helpful. So I encourage maybe a cursory reading and then go back and maybe pick a couple, because I decided that like my values were everything and everything was my values, and that's not healthy. So looking through, picking a few things, it's actually interesting to me because I had told myself that I needed to do this again. Like, I just had this feeling like I really kind of wasn't filtering really anything through my values, and I really wanted to get centered around that. And then this ended up, to me, being applicable and important work, maybe for all of us. And it can serve as a reminder. This isn't new. Like, you already have these values, and you're already living into these values every day. But sometimes knowing them and being able to speak to them, it can be extremely helpful. Being able to say, you know, the reason I'm not doing this is not because I'm a slacker. The reason I'm not doing this is not because I don't honor this person. The reason I'm doing this is because this doesn't align with my values. That's a really different way of framing how you live your life. And I've had a few situations where I've had to actually say that. Like, I'm not going to do that because that is just, it doesn't work with my values. And that was really scary to say to someone. It sounded to me, I was afraid they would judge me or think that I was like value woman, you know, like showing up with all me and all my values. And instead it was like, oh, well then you shouldn't go do that. Like the person was just like, well then you definitely are right and you should not do that. And I was like, thank you. So it can actually be not just a way in which you are governed from a place of greater joy, but it can actually model for other people that they can say no, and that they can say no based on their values. So I don't suggest you carry this worksheet around when you everywhere you go, but I think that when we model opportunities like getting in touch with ourselves and knowing ourselves and unbecoming so that we can become who we truly are, other people notice. Like, it's just really, it's really obvious, because when we begin to do things like that, that is outside of the norm. It is the norm to be governed by expectations and by to-do lists and by planners. And so when you begin to live out of a place of deep-seated values that are instilled based on, you know, your faith and your family and your life, that is noticeable to other people. And it will cause people to be curious.
So that's a good number.
What?
What's a good ballpark number?
Ballpark value number. I like this. So One thing I was going to say is, like, for those of you who are married, you know, it might be important that, this not be a solo thing, that you as a couple decide these are the values that are going to govern our decision making, so that, you know, you're just kind of on the same page. She suggests 1 to 2.
I think 1 to 2.
1 to, I know, isn't that hard? Which is why when I had 50 values, I was like, basically everything goes because I value all the things, which was not helpful. So 1 to 2 is helpful. I would say that's kind of up to you to decide. But if there's 2 people involved, you know, you might decide you each get 2 values to contribute into the family system. But even as individuals, I think it's important to be able to do this. I've also suggested to people before that incorporating your children in picking some of these values might be really important. Being able to have them as a part of the decision-making, thank you, decision-making system can mean that, you know, if you decide that, let's say you decide that your value is, you know, honesty, well, then if something comes up or someone is, you know, being dishonest, you can say, well, what are our values? You know, let's talk through this from a place with your children of values. If one of your values is, let's say, love, and there's bickering or quarrel, you can say, well, hold on, I think we decided as a group that one of our values is love, and so how can we, even in this time of challenge, be loving to one another?